Money Radio, thank you so much for joining us. It is a pleasure now to welcome Scott Woolley. He is a technology and business writer, formerly a Forbes telecom correspondent and the magazine's West Coast Bureau Chief. He has written about technology and business affairs for several publications, and he has now written a new book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age, The Network by Scott Woolley. Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
By the way, this interview is streaming live on the internet, and later it will be archived. So if anybody is listening or wants to listen, you can just turn your computer on and pull down this interview on the laser pipes, I suppose.
Yeah, that is not a bad segue into this idea of how communications networks have changed and evolved, starting 100 years ago with radio and here today with the merger of the internet and radio. Absolutely.
Really, a lot of the technology from a little over 100 years ago set the groundwork for the communication revolution that we've been undergoing just in the past 20 years. And it started with some very familiar names, Marconi, of course, but then a fellow that probably doesn't get the recognition, actually several fellows that probably don't get the recognition they deserve, the general and the major, David Sarnoff, and Edwin Armstrong.
Yes, Marconi, that's a very good way of putting it. People do know the name Marconi. He's often sort of billed as the father of radio. What I found in my research is that is certainly not true from a sort of inventor standpoint, although it is in many ways true from a kind of salesman. He had this ability to take an idea of, the fact that people could wirelessly communicate in 1900 was generally seen as either, fraud or some sort of magic. And so Marconi really did have that ability to sell this idea and get people to believe. And then there were people like Edwin Armstrong, this brilliant inventor, who had far more technical skill but lacked any of that sort of salesmanship.
And then David Sarnoff, who was kind of in between the two.
A bit
of a salesman, a heck of a businessman, but also had some pretty good technical background.
Absolutely, and that's one of the fascinating things. The things that have been written about these guys generally in the past have generally taken a fairly simplistic view, kind of taken, I don't know that if that's fair, but taken Armstrong's side of the argument that Sarnoff, they started off as great friends, but, Sarnoff has sort of developed this reputation as just being more like I described Marconi, as this kind of self-interested businessman who took advantage of the technology. And the way you put it, I think, is really much closer to the truth, because Sarnoff had this deep love of technology, of the airwaves, and the people who could control them. And it was really his passion and optimism for finding new ways to help people communicate that drove so much of the early part of wireless technology.
Let's tell a little bit of this story. Sarnoff, a young immigrant to the United States, at an early age managed to land a job with Marconi's company in New York. And went up through the ranks and eventually became very successful meeting people along the way. By the way, the story about Marconi and his trip to New York on the Lusitania instead of the Titanic was just a spellbinding bit of writing there.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I mean, I was fortunate because the history just broke in such an interesting way where Marconi, it's 1912, and, his company is struggling because he's been promising that he could send wireless telegrams across the Atlantic for the past 12 years, and he hasn't done it. So he's coming to New York sort of desperate to raise more money. A lot of people have really turned on him. And in order to get there for the annual meeting, he has to give up his ticket on the Titanic and get a ticket on the Lusitania, which is becomes famous later. And so not only does he avoid drowning, the Titanic sinking then becomes this worldwide publicity for his technology, because it's the two Marconi operators on the Titanic who summon help and are the only reason that the 700 some people survive. So that was that. It was this amazing moment where things look pretty bad for his technology, and then not only does he personally escape disaster, that disaster ends up helping save his company. So it was a fascinating moment in history.
He became really something of a hero for his technology. And that technology, interesting, one of the major uses for it, there was some use for ships at sea, but really it was, the idea was to be able to get stock quotes back and forth between London and New York.
Yes, well, for anybody who's read Flash Boys by Michael Lewis, we'll have some appreciation. You know, there's in the modern era, there's this debate over high-frequency trading and how people are taking advantage in the stock market by, you know, getting their orders in faster. It was the same thing in 1900 in the undersea cables. The undersea telegraph cables existed primarily so that you could buy a stock in New York and then sell it in London for a little bit more and kind of lock in a profit. So those cables, I really didn't know before I started this story, were the kind of the first instance of high-frequency trading, or flash boys, as I guess we'd call them now.
So we've got high-frequency trading going on in the 1910s, and all this stuff is being created. What was it about that time period that led to such incredible invention?
Well, part of it was that Heinrich Hertz, this German scientist, kind of proves that the airwaves really exist in around 1888. And so it's at the very beginning of the 20th century that these waves in the air start to compete with the wires on the ground. By that point, you know, the first undersea transatlantic telegraph cable was actually started working around 1866. So those things had been around. The telephone network existed, the telegraph network existed, and then all of a sudden there was this new competitor in the airwaves that could do things that none of these older wired networks could. And you still see that tension today with, you know, fiber optic technology versus our smartphones. The different the ways of wired and wireless communication have always been sort of competitors. And it was that moment at the beginning of the 20th century when these guys all became friends and started working on it that this new era of technology really dawned.
And then in the background of Marconi and Edison and Bell and all these other great inventors, Tesla and such, you've got Edwin Armstrong, who kind of comes up out of nowhere, a well-educated man, a practical scientist, and he really comes up with the idea for amplitude modulation and later frequency modulation, AM and FM as we know them today.
Well, I would say certainly that's true for FM to give, and this was part of the problem of sort of dividing up credit. You know, Armstrong, I think, made the most important inventions that led to AM radio. There were other major inventions that were critical components, certainly, and people had done voice broadcasting before, you know, while he was still in high school. But it was his invention, especially of the vacuum tube amplifier, kind of the predecessor of the transistor, that really made amplification possible. And then all of a sudden, you know, he and Sarnoff have this kind of magical moment in 1914 where he takes this new invention, this amplifier, hooks it up to the Marconi company's antennas that Sarnoff has access to, and they for the first time see that, wow, we can start hearing signals from the far side of the globe. They were in New Jersey, and they start listening to Germany and Hawaii. And it was that, especially that invention, that vacuum tube amplifier that Armstrong created, that really made AM possible. And then 20 years later, in 1933, he invites David Sarnoff up to his labs at Columbia University and shows him FM radio, this entirely new form of radio that he's patented. So Armstrong, as an inventor, compared to all those other names you listed, Tesla, Edison, Marconi, Armstrong doesn't really rank in the public imagination, but as a scientist, he certainly should.
And we forget about the importance of this technology when it comes to World War I and World War II. It's probably impossible to measure the number of Allied lives that were saved because of this technology.
Absolutely. I was shocked to know in World War II that one of the Allies' secret weapons, and this didn't actually make it into the book much, but they were building these vacuum tubes into the noses of artillery shells so that they could shoot down kamikazes, and they would actually send out little radio signals, and when they got close to the incoming airplane, they would explode. Basically, the anti-aircraft had radar in it. I had no idea, and this was a huge advantage in the Battle of the Bulge, Patton. They hadn't wanted to use these shells for fear that the Germans would get a hold of them and design them and use them against us. And finally, in the Battle of the Bulge, Patton started raining down these shells that sent out little radio waves, and so when they were 20 feet above the ground, they would explode. And all of a sudden, all the Germans in their foxholes realized their foxholes didn't work so well anymore. So the way the airwaves invisibly turned the course of World War II, especially, and also played a key role in World War I, was a fascinating news to me and a sort of interesting side note in this whole story.
Meanwhile, Armstrong had a difficult life. He ended up in litigation throughout much of his life, fighting for his patents. The patent office was not really ready to keep track of all this new technology that was taking place. There was a fight that eventually developed between Sarnoff and Armstrong over FM. And by this time, Sarnoff was head of RCA and then later NBC.
Yeah, Sarnoff has gone from this penniless Russian immigrant who shows up in 1900 and then through his job with the Marconi Company rises to run. You know, the Radio Corporation of America took over the Marconi Company after World War I when the American government figured out this stuff's important and we don't want a British company controlling American radio. So that's where the Radio Corporation of America came from, and Sarnoff was there. He was the general manager, rose to run it, and then they created the National Broadcasting Company so that all of RCA's radios would have something to play on the air. And so by the time FM came along, and this was always Armstrong's contention, Sarnoff had this AM radio empire to protect, and so Armstrong became convinced that his friend had betrayed him in order to cripple FM radio and protect his AM empire. And that was sort of the standard story that had been generally accepted in the past. You know, most people sort of took Armstrong's side, but I do think the full story ended up being a lot more complicated.
Yeah, meanwhile, Sarnoff goes on to be involved in one of the first real radio broadcasts for public consumption, the Dempsey fight. Later becomes involved in one of the first actual television broadcasts. And then, of course, probably well known for bringing color television to our lives.
Yeah, that was the thing that I started writing this book, I figured Sarnoff would be a villain, sort of the villain of the piece, and tell it in a slightly new way. And one of the reasons I really came around on him, and one of the things that his friend Armstrong could never really see, was his love and passion for the next technology. You know, he said at one point, "I'm not very interested in yesterday and barely interested in today. It's tomorrow I care about." I'm paraphrasing slightly. And it was that ability to look forward and be an optimist about what was possible that made him help get the wireless telegraph started across the Atlantic, AM radio broadcasting, television, as you said, color television. He was always passionate and always believed that the airwaves had more power that people could unlock. And I think that was ultimately a really truer picture of who he was, and far less this sort of scheming businessman that his friend had made him out to be.
As we continue our conversation, Scott, I'd like to take a look at where we stand now in the communications age, and what are some of the lessons learned from some of these pioneers in the industry. A new book, The Network, and it's really a very interesting story. The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age by Scott Woolley, and we'll continue the conversation in just a moment. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're talking with Scott Woolley. He is the author of The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. And if you don't know the story of Marconi and Sarnoff and Armstrong and so many others that were involved in things like AM, FM, television, really you go beyond that, though, and you get into satellites, you get into the Internet. Sarnoff predicted the Internet back before there was an Internet.
Well, that was one really amazing thing to me, and I should say that the story, I think that there's, it starts with a sort of different take on the story of Marconi and Sarnoff and Armstrong, but it does then grow into this place, and something that Sarnoff's definitely not given enough credit for is his vision of the Internet that he sort of came to in the 1960s. And at this point, he's in his 70s. He's sort of being shuffled off for retirement, and yet he's still in the RCA labs looking at, and he identified the two critical technologies that would really make the Internet possible, the first being the microchip, and the second being what he called laser pipes, what we now call fiber optic cables, but in fact are glass cables that we shoot lasers down to communicate. And his phrase, laser pipes, is clearly the better term for the technology. But he put that together and envisioned this universal network that would connect the world and convey all sorts of information, whether it's books or magazines or radio programs, or he didn't say web pages, but television shows. And it was that ability. His ability as a technological prophet, I think, was just unmatched. And so his ability to forecast in stunning detail what the Internet was going to look like in 1966 is sort of the fitting capper to his career.
What are you seeing now, though, and what are the lessons to be learned from these pioneers of communications as they apply to today?
Well, especially on the regulatory front, the ability of people to sort of trick the government into giving them control and the value from the airwaves. It happened again and again, and to some extent there was just flat-out corruption in the FCC and in Congress. But the danger with the airwaves is that they're kind of easy to steal because nobody understands them. And so if you try to steal land or oil or gold, it's kind of easy to get your head around what's happening. When people gain the legal right to use a certain band of frequencies, it's much harder for people to get upset about that as theft. And so over and over again through the 20th century, and I think there are echoes of it today, this valuable natural resource that's invisible and is intangible is also an easy source of corruption. And so there has to be a lot of attention paid into exactly what rules are being made into Washington, because it's going to determine the future of communications.
And briefly, in the next minute or so, what kind of rule should we look for the best results for innovation and the broader use of the Internet and other communications tools?
Well, I take a little bit of a middle ground. Some people are very much, on the property rights. If instead of having the government decide who uses these, we make it more like a standard piece of property, and that works well in the cell phone industry. There needs to be a balance with things like Wi-Fi, unlicensed technologies that we can use. So if we can create a system where there are more Wi-Fi waves, so we have a lot of access to free networks, and then there are also for longer distance networks, private networks that can kind of manage the traffic, that ends up working better. So it's a tricky test. It's a tricky question. But if we can get that balance of a little bit of Wi-Fi, a little bit of the private property rights, and some of the airwaves, we can develop all manner of networks that let us communicate cheaply and effectively.
I found it to be a very interesting, just an intriguing book. The Network tells the history, not just of radio and television, but brings us really into the communications age. The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. The Network by Scott Woolley. Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Scott.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.